This year marks 100 years since the birth of the remarkable Rosalind Franklin, born on the 25th of July 1920. Her distinguished career in crystallography not only led to understanding the structure of DNA, but also advanced studies on coal and carbon, as well as the structure of viruses. I'm science journalist Izzy Clark, and this centenary series from the Rosalind Franklin Institute explores Franklin's life, legacy, and in this episode, her work. She was working on the structure of viruses when she died at the young age of 37, and her epitaph reads that her research and discoveries on viruses remain of lasting benefit to mankind. This impressive career started in Cambridge, where she'd been studying natural sciences as an undergraduate, and in 1941, Franklin finished her degree. She knew she wanted to continue in science, but also work on something that contributed to the war effort, and that was by studying coal and carbon. In 1942, Franklin worked as an assistant research officer for BCURA, the British Coal Utilisation Research Association, producing a PhD thesis on the porosity of coal. Then, in 1947, she moved to Paris to study the crystallography, the arrangement of atoms, of coal and graphite. Her family hadn't quite realised the success of her work until she wrote home from a conference in America.
In the carbon world, the work I did in Paris seems to form the background to a large part of the industrial research going on here, and I'm welcomed as an authority on the subject. So much so that I had a nightmare in which I was surrounded by solemn, middle-aged Americans, all saying, "And what we should like to ask your opinion about next, Miss Franklin, is..." And then I woke up.
Judith Howard is a professor of chemistry at Durham University and explained how Rosalind became such a name in this field.
When she was working in Cambridge, it was largely physical chemistry methods, looking at density, looking at porosity. She would absorb gases into the poruses, then she would work with different solvents to see which ones would go into the pores. But that was usually using largely physical chemistry methods, but she did have to invent her own apparatus to do these experiments. It was when she went to France and she worked with Mathieu Mering that she was able to begin her studies using X-ray diffraction, and that led her to more discoveries, more papers, and so on, and eventually into the work that she did when she came back to the UK.
And so for those that are new to this field, what exactly is X-ray diffraction?
X-ray diffraction is a technique we use to determine the internal arrangement of atoms and molecules in crystalline materials. I say crystalline materials because those have order. In other words, a number of atoms in one piece of space matches the next one and the next one, rather like a wallpaper pattern. Frightfully bad analogy, but we use it. Other materials which are not so ordered, which is like coal, require a slightly different technique and certainly a different level of interpretation. But the diffraction methods we use, we focus a fine beam of X-rays onto a tiny crystalline sample and we record the diffraction pattern, so-called. In those days, it was on photographic film. Nowadays, it's electronically. The pattern that you get from the experiment, not only are they beautiful in many cases because there's fantastic symmetry and patterns and shapes, but that is not readable, interpretable just by looking at it. You have to use mathematical formulae. From there, using, again, intuition to a large extent, then you can interpret where the atoms were, in which part of the structure, if you like, how they're joined together, how far apart they are, and even what atom type they are.
So what was it about coal that she had found out and was exploring?
Yes, Rosalind had carried out her X-ray experiments in Paris, which led to the conclusion that some forms of coal were graphitizing, so-called, as she named them. And that meant that on heating the powdered coal, that they would lead to a structure that easily converted to graphite. And graphite is important, was important. Okay, it's the stuff we have in our pencils, but nonetheless, the work that she did would lead eventually towards the formation, which is well used today, of carbon fibres. It's a light but very strong product. The other form of coal that she found from her work in Paris, so-called non-graphitising coal, the internal structure there was much more rigid. The bonding between the carbon atoms and the arrangement, which wasn't ordered, but it was semi-ordered in the sense that she was able to determine what the arrangement was of the atoms and the way in which they formed these porous materials that led to the term molecular sieves. And the porous nature did mean that you could use that type of coal in a different way. And what she did and her work showed the internal structure, the way the carbon atoms were joined together. But it wasn't easy because it wasn't a clear diffraction pattern.
How important was Rosalind Franklin's intuition for something like this?
They weren't clear, sharp diffraction patterns like we might expect to get from a single protein crystal today. They were somewhat diffuse. She had to use the knowledge that she had and her intuition, and she, if you like, honed a lot of her skills, which would be useful in later work in the experiments that she did in Paris.
Just how much of a new discovery was that for the time? How much did we really know about coal and carbon and what it was doing?
Very, very little, in fact. I mean, this is why it's so important. She published a huge number of papers during the time she was doing her PhD and beyond, particularly when she went to France, and many of these were single-author papers, which was unheard of then. And so by the time she was 30, she had a significant reputation in the study of coal and was invited to give talks and so on. But it was, her papers are still now quoted as some of the classics in the field.
After four happy years in Paris, Rosalind returned to London in 1951 to venture into the world of biology and use these X-ray techniques to study the structure of DNA.
I am, of course, most ignorant about all things biological, but I imagine most X-ray people start out that way. I'm certainly interested in the biological X-ray work.
There had been a hunt to understand genetic inheritance. How did we inherit characteristics from our parents? Rosalind joined a lab in King's College London to tackle this big question by studying the structure of DNA, working under John Randall and alongside Maurice Wilkins. But there was some tension in the lab, as James Naismith, the director of the Rosalind Franklin Institute, explains.
Wilkins had been given the impression that Franklin was coming to work for him, that Randall had recruited Franklin as somebody who Wilkins could task because of her expertise to work on this problem. So when she had arrived at King's, Wilkins and others had begun to make some progress. They had been able to record X-ray images of DNA fibres. Now, they couldn't interpret them, but it meant that there was somewhere a goal that this could be interpretable, that you could get from X-ray structures, X-ray analysis, I should say, from that to the structure of the molecule of DNA, and therefore from the structure of the molecule to DNA to understand how it worked. So Franklin came in at that sort of exciting time that people were had shown that DNA fibres diffracted X-rays and had order. And when she came in, the question was, well, can we make sense of these patterns or can we improve them? Can we get better data that would allow us to make sense of those patterns?
Where does that begin then, trying to make sense of these patterns?
So when Franklin came, she brought her expertise in X-ray diffraction. So others were competent, but she was really very good at this. And she began to build an X-ray instrument where she could control the humidity of the fibres. People had a clue that the hydration state was important, but not really any understanding of it. And so what she did was set out to systematically control the hydration state of DNA fibres and then to take X-ray images of those fibres.
How important is that hydration state?
Absolutely. So the problem that Franklin's work showed was that everybody had been working with a mixed A and B form and it was never the same 2 days in a row. So this was the problem, was that they could see a pattern, but in fact what they were seeing was two patterns superimposed on one another. And depending on the percentage of A and percentage of B, then what you actually saw was a different blending of the two. She was able to separate them out into a pure A form and a pure B form because she was able to control the hydration and keep it constant over the experiment. And so this was a big breakthrough.
Okay, so which is which? What is the difference between A and which one's B?
The B form of DNA is the one that gives rise to the famous photograph 51. It is the one that is the most hydrated and is in fact quite a simple or a relatively simple pattern. The A form pattern is much more complex and that comes from a dehydrated form of DNA that turns out to be biologically relevant but it took a long while for people to understand what that relevance was. That was almost 60 years after Franklin had begun to describe it before people really understood that the A-form wasn't just like an artifact of sample preparation.
But it's an image of the B-form that has gone down in history. Photograph 51. The fuzzy X-ray image looks like an X that's periodically broken up in patches. It's the diffraction pattern from a strand of DNA held at 92% humidity. The clearest shot of life's building blocks ever seen up to that point, and was the vital image that demonstrated the double helix structure of DNA.
By the time Franklin had gotten these images, the issue between her and Maurice Wilkins had come to a head. And Randall had sort of brokered a peace agreement, which was that Franklin would focus on A and Wilkins would focus on B.
That must have formed quite a disconnect, because if you've got one person over there and the other on the other side of the room working on a different thing, is that what was going on? Was there not much interaction because there was this tension?
Yes. So the King's group wasn't functional as a group. Not really. And if you compare that to what was going on up at Cambridge, where it was a come one, come all approach of people discussing data and nonsense ideas being destroyed by people with who come in and look at it and say, well, that can't be right. From my expertise tells me that thing is wrong. And that constant refreshing and swapping of information was really what drove the Cambridge group.
Leading this Cambridge group were James Watson and Francis Crick. And in April 1953, Crick and Watson published their discovery. The molecular structure of DNA was a double helix.
What the key thing for them was photograph 51. Because they had been thinking about models, photograph 51 told Crick something really important, because he was able to work out the space group, and it told Watson something really important about the helical nature of the B form. And that was the leap. They immediately saw that leap.
So how was it that they were able to see photograph 51?
So that remains mired in controversy. As my understanding, and I may be corrected, is that they had actually seen it through an MRC report. And that report was detailed enough for them to be able to measure distances from the photograph. So they were able to actually convert that into metrics. And once they'd done that, they made the leap from there. Sorry, I should say the controversy was that they probably shouldn't have seen that MRC report. There is a second argument, which is this was taxpayers-funded research from both sides, and that you shouldn't be keeping taxpayers-funded research secret. Just because you collect the data doesn't mean you own it, and so you should share data. The problem was that the lack of attribution for the contribution that Rosalind made to this has been what has made such a controversy over the years.
And so Watson and Crick do publish their findings, the double helix structure of DNA in Nature. What happens from that point? Does Rosalind get any credit at all?
She publishes a paper in the same issue with Nature. So she publishes her work in Nature. And it's seen then as an important piece of work that established that you had an A form and a B form and the distances were reported. So it's a really important paper. But by the time the Nobel Prize was awarded, Rosalind Franklin was dead. And so she couldn't and didn't get the Nobel Prize because it wasn't possible. And Maurice Wilkins, who we heard earlier on in this tale, was the third recipient of the Nobel Prize. But very few people have ever heard of Maurice Wilkins, ironically, and yet he is the third Nobel Prize winner for the structure of DNA.
I know it's all speculative, but do you think that if Rosalind had been alive, that she would have been the third person to receive the Nobel Prize?
I can't say. What I would say is that Aaron Klug, who was Rosalind Franklin's student and subsequently won the Nobel Prize and was president of the Royal Society, Aaron Klug felt that she would have got there, that she had begun her analysis of the work and really would have made the connections herself in time. So, you know, he very much pushed against this notion that had been created that Rosalind Franklin was somehow lacked the insight, she had no idea what she'd got, kind of thing. You know, she just stumbled on this great piece of experimental data, but she had no idea what to do with it. And he really disproved that by going through her notebooks and pointing out her ideas that she was thinking of. She was a really talented experimentalist, and science needs the very best experimentalists, and that was something she was exceptionally good at.
Rosalind left King's after 2 years and, in 1953, moved to Birkbeck University, where her own research team, of which Aaron Klug was a part of, studied the structure of tobacco mosaic virus.
The work is concerned with what is probably the most fundamental of all questions concerning the mechanism of living processes, namely, the relationship between protein and nucleic acid in the living cell. Although the work is at present being done exclusively on plant viruses, there is no doubt that a large part of the results obtained will also be relevant to the problems of animal viruses. In no other laboratory, either in this country or elsewhere, is any comparable work on virus structure being undertaken.
This virus leaves a white mosaic pattern on plants and wipes out not just tobacco plants, but potatoes, tomatoes, aubergine and peppers. I spoke with biochemist Elspeth Garman from Oxford University, who explained Rosalind's work and why this virus was such an issue.
Industrially, until genetic engineering of resistant strains, it was a huge problem for tobacco plants. It was identified as a pathogen in the 1930s, even though it had been known well before that. And people started studying it, and they discovered that it was amazingly resilient because it was not temperature sensitive. So many viruses will actually be killed by high temperatures, but it was not. So it survived, and also it could survive not on its host. And this made it a huge problem because it could stay infectious for months on steaks, in greenhouse benches, on clothing, and get spread that way.
Gosh, it sounds like quite the pest. So what was Rosalind and her team at Birkbeck trying to find out?
Basically, it was the three-dimensional shape of the virus. They wanted to understand how it infected the plants. If you can find the structure of something, then you can work out which parts of the genetic material are exposed and so on, and you can perhaps work out the mechanism of action. And this is what's used for finding out how things work. And you combine that with the biochemical evidence, the biophysical experiments, for instance, they're trying to find out when you heat it up, whether it's still active or not.
But there were a lot of unknowns. Some people thought the virus could be any length. Others thought that they were like a tiny rod, just hundreds of nanometers long. And it is tiny, a nanometer being a millionth of a millimeter. What was known was that the genetic material, called RNA, was inside, but again, it wasn't known how it was arranged. All of this is what Rosalind wanted to find out.
Because she was an absolute expert, a really gifted experimentalist, she thought she could take better photographs by X-ray diffraction than had been taken up to that point. And in fact, she was right. And from these measurements, she hypothesized in 1955 in a paper in Nature several new things about tobacco mosaic virus. And people violently disagreed with her, including the person who had been providing her with the samples, who was called Norman Pirie from the Rothamsted Research Station. So the things she came up with from her measurements of these gel-like samples was that they could only be 300 nanometers long, that's that they were all the same length, like a rod, that the RNA was coiled inside, the coil repeat was 2.3 nanometers, and that the RNA was hollow, and the RNA being coiled inside in a regular way in a helix as well.
So tobacco mosaic virus looks like a rod with all the viral proteins on the outside that help stick to the cells that they want to infect, and the RNA winds around inside the hollow centre. Understanding this, the structure of tobacco mosaic virus allowed the infection process to be understood. In the autumn of 1956, Rosalind was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. But in the summer of 1957, already ill, she was excited to make models of the virus that she had been studying to go on a public display at the Royal Society.
The first model that her group built of the tobacco mosaic virus is very famous because the best thing that she could think of to represent the protein unit sticking out of the core of the helix was bicycle handlebar grips. And they went to the bicycle shop. She sent one of her team and they bought as many as they could. They had about 300 of these and 288 of them went to make the model. But they also made a very, very famous model that went to Belgium in 1958, which still exists.
Rosalind had worked throughout her illness, even moving on to study poliovirus. But sadly, she didn't live to see the display at the Brussels World Fair and passed away on the 16th of April 1958, aged 37. Towards the end of our conversation, Elspeth reflected on the importance of Rosalind's work.
It was the beginning of a huge effort to actually find the three-dimensional shape of viruses using X-ray techniques. And these were developed further by many other researchers. Don Casper was working on these. Watson did more on it at that time. And in the UK, David Stewart, who's now the Life Sciences Director at Darmond, he solved the structure of foot and mouth disease virus and then blue tongue virus here. And the foot and mouth disease virus work has eventually led to a more stable vaccine. The structures are still right. They've been made higher resolution and we understand more about them now and the mechanism of action of these viruses so that resistant strains have been able to be engineered genetically and so on.
And looking at it, I mean, it's remarkable that someone can have such a big impact, you know, working on coals and carbon, then DNA and viruses. So what has her work done for science today?
Well, as you say, she made remarkable discoveries in all three of the areas that she looked at, and that was all by the age of 37. What we've been talking about was the critical work on viruses. She just started that in 1953 when she went to Birkbeck. She died in 1958. And the first year, she spent just reading everything she could about viruses because her equipment wasn't ready and she didn't have anything to do experiments on. So, you know, we're talking about 3 years of work to achieve all these studies on different viruses. And she was starting to work on poliovirus before she died. And that has been incredibly important. To think that you could attack something like that, human virus, and understand it. So I think that the foundation she laid bore great fruit.
And that legacy is what we'll be exploring next time for our third and final episode of the Centenary series. Thank you to Judith Howard, James Naismith, and Elspeth Garman, and to the Franklin family for the use of Rosalind's letters. I'm Izzy Clark, and this has been a Campus PR production for the Rosalind Franklin Institute. You can listen to episode one about Rosalind Franklin's life on their website. That's rfi.ac.uk.